Hello and thanks for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 251.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m.
A quarter of a millennium of podcasts have passed and the world's longest running football fans podcast keeps on trucking. Thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading. It may be mid-season and the Champions League draw has just happened. We've not even hit the Glasgow Fair and we're talking about the season to come. But before we get into all of that, St Anthony's brought us yet another special guest. And this time, that famous teacher dress-alike, Mr Graeme Spears. Before we get on to our interview between St Anthony and the four-time sports writer of the year, Mr Spears, I'd just like to say you're not getting away with it in relation to not talking about the Celtic FC Fund. You can do anything for the foundation. You don't have to do an official event. You can run the half marathon in October. You can do a variety of things and raise funds for the Celtic FC Foundation. And also today, the Celtic FC Foundation announced that there would be a charity match taking place at East End Park, Dunfermline, on Sunday the 6th of September to mark the 30th anniversary of Jock Stein's passing. If you're at all interested in anything Celtic FC Foundation does, you can go to, you can email cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk, that's cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk, telephone 0141 551 4321. Enough of me twittering on. It's the star of many a Radio Scotland programme, golf during the summer, football during the winter. It's the thinking man's journalist in Scotland, one of the two of them. It's Mr. Graeme Spears, with him, St Anthony.
And all the science I don't understand, it's just my job 5 days a week. A rocket.
Hi and welcome to a podcast with Graeme Spears. I'd just like to welcome Graeme along and thank him for taking time to come along. And I just discovered there that you've been sports writer, Scotland Sports Writer of the Year 4 times.
In the dim and distant past, yes.
So is
I'm a has-been.
But standards have sort of declined in recent years because your man Jackson's winning it every year these days.
Yeah, that's a case in point. I mean, Keith, quite rightly, I think, wins... They've split it up. It used to be in the old days it was just purely for writing, where guys like myself and Tom English and other guys had quite a good time with it, you know, for kind of writing awards. But it was quite true back then that the award kind of disparaged news reporters, or didn't include them, who were breaking good news stories, because it was purely based on writing. So they split it up into two, the writing side of it and the news breaking side of it. So I used to, yeah, I think that these were awards were for a writing thing, but it's quite right now that they've got a kind of news reporter of the year as well as a sports writer of the year. Quite right, they've got two different categories.
So,
but thanks for raising it, I'd forgotten about that.
you're too modest to mention it. The first thing we always ask on the podcast is, what was the first game you attended and who was your first football hero?
Well, the first game I attended is a bit of a mystery. I lived in Anstruther when I was a wee kid, and I've got a recollection of going to the old Bayview, East Fife's ground. Been taken there by my dad to see, I think, East Fife against Aberdeen. And my memory of it is, I remember being, I would be 4 or 5 at the time. This would be in the late 60s, maybe 69, something like that. And I remember being at the old Bayview, and I remember this. When you're a wee kid, you remember the vivid colours of the strips. That's what sticks in your mind. And I remember, I think, the all-red of Aberdeen. And I also have a strange, vague memory of seeing Arthur Graham, who played for Aberdeen at the time. Why I would remember that, aged 5, I don't know. However, my memory is probably a bit foggy because Donald Walker, who's a sports journalist at The Scotsman, who's an East Fife fan, he says there's only fleeting records of East Fife playing Aberdeen. One was in 67 and one was in 71. or something like that, and I'm thinking of this game being in between these two dates, so I'm a bit foggy about it. The first game I went to was definitely at the old Bayview when I lived in Anstruther, and it was East Fife versus somebody, and I think it was Aberdeen, but it might have been Hearts or somebody else, but somebody wearing a kind of reddish top. I've always said it was against Aberdeen, but the history books might not back that up.
Mm-hmm. And what about hero? Who would have been your first hero?
My hero was Sir William Bud Johnson, great winger for Rangers throughout the 70s, early 80s, well, before he went to West Brom. Willie Johnson, my hero. And I just loved him when I was a wee kid. I used to, when we moved to Glasgow, my dad, who was a great football fan, my dad was never a supporter of any club. Mm. I never remember him being a Rangers fan or a Celtic fan or a Partick Thistle fan or anything, but he loved going to the football. And we started going to Ibrox when we moved to Glasgow, and that's when I became a Rangers fan when I was a kid. And I loved Willie Johnson. I just loved his daredevilry. I loved his impudence. I loved his pace. He was classically gallus, the way he walked, the way he conducted himself.
And yet when you talk about Rangers wingers, he tends to go overlooked. You talk about Henderson and you talk about McLean maybe and Cooper and Loudon.
Yeah.
But Willie Johnson was certainly as good as any of them, I speak.
The funny thing is, they also talk about being a role model as a footballer and behaving yourself in front of young kids. Well, Willie Johnson quite evidently didn't do that. I thought he was brilliant, though. I mean, that kind of thing didn't register with me. I just thought he was a brilliant...
Stick.
Yeah, he was gallus, he was quick, he had swagger in the park. Now, at that time in the early 70s, funnily enough, I can't really remember Willie Henderson, who was just fading out of the scene at Rangers at that time. But Willie Johnson, when I started going to Ibrox around about 70, 71, when we moved to Glasgow, Willie Johnson was just, you know, in his prime and was coming good, was brilliant. and he had this amazing career, didn't he? I think he was in the Rangers team 67, 68, went to Argentina 78, we know about tragedy.
He was a fit guy.
Yeah.
Played right on till the...
And then, of course, he came back to Rangers in about 80 or 81. I mean, his career, and then Hearts, his professional career probably lasted about 17 or 18 years. But in the early 70s, for a wee kid like me, going to watch Rangers, Willie Johnson was, for me, what Jimmy Johnson would have been to Celtic fans. He was just brilliant. He was he was exhilarating to watch.
Yeah, and did you ever get to interview Willie Johnson?
Aye, that's the fun. I mean, the really weird thing is when I then got going in journalism and people... The really strange thing is when I then got going in journalism and people would know me through journalism, I would meet guys like Colin Steen and Willie Johnson, who I had adored as a kid, and if anything, they would slightly defer to me as a journalist, and I would say, look guys, this is the other way around. I'm really privileged and honoured to meet you. And I used to find it really odd when I went to interview Willie Johnson a couple of times, and he would know me as a journalist, and I would think, well, I've got no right to be known by him, and he's got every right to be known by me. So it was always a bit strange going to interview guys that had been your heroes as a kid. I don't know if he's still doing it, but Willie Johnson ran a pub in Kirkcaldy and was great fun to interview. And of course, you know, when you look back at his career, it was strewn with, I mean, what was it? Did he get some 13 or 14 red cards, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, indiscipline and hot-headedness on the pitch. But I take nothing away from him as a footballer. And a really decent, affable guy to meet now. I find that with a lot of footballers now, a lot of guys from the 70s and 80s that you meet now who are an older generation, they're very convivial, very conversational, pretty...
Most of them just want to be remembered, I think. They're just happy to talk about old days.
Yeah, I find a lot of old footballers gracious in their own way. I've interviewed Colin Steen, I've interviewed Willie Johnson, I've interviewed Ronnie McKinnon, I've interviewed Evan Williams, I've interviewed Charlie Gallagher, I've interviewed an absolute stack of old players, and without fail, they've been really decent guys who have been great to talk to.
We're going to touch that later, because you're in the habit of doing these interviews recently, with the old players.
Yeah, retro. Yeah,
the retro ones, which I have to say, that for somebody my age, it's great to read. What I was going to say there is, in the old Ibrox, before it was all seated, so where would your spot have been?
Oh, the same spot every week for a decade. We moved to Glasgow, we lived in Bears Den, and my dad, who loved football, like I said, didn't support any club, but just loved football. The two grounds we would go to would be Ibrox or Firhill. We were in Bears Den, you could go through the Clyde Tunnel, be at Ibrox in 20 minutes. So we would go to Ibrox most weeks, and we'd be at the uncovered terrace in what's now the Broomland, the Broomland, the away end.
Yeah, traditionally what we called the Celtic.
Right, you would. I didn't. I just knew it as the away end.
No, but the funny thing is, at Celtic Park, you always referred to the Rangers end as the Rangers end.
Yeah. Okay. So. Well. You get there, you'd park the car, you'd go up the big steep
steps.
You, I don't know if you remember it, but if you there was a wall that that ran about 20 yards, you'd walk, which separated you from the scene of the pitch, from the visual beauty to your right as you arrived at the top of the terracing. And I can always remember you walked along this passageway until you got to the end of the wall, and there the whole scene opened up in front of you. The old oval bowl, especially in August, the green grass. It was a fantastic scene. The gathering crowd. It's so
there was
vivid.
Something about the old grounds, I think, that had a majesty rather than what we've got these days.
I mean, that Ibrox scene is so vivid in my mind from the old Ibrox. It was for a kid aged 9 or 10, 11.
I'll tell you a game you might remember. And I was in the old Celtic end at Ibrox, and maybe a handful of occasions before it was knocked down and made into the Broomland stand. It was I spoke to Gordon Smith about this last year because it's one of his favourite games. Celtic were 2-0 up at half time, and Shoggy Edwardson had scored twice. And I'll never forget being in the Celtic end. It was jumping all the way through half time. It was just singing and dancing and a sea of green and white. And in contrast, you could see the Rangers end, and there's nothing, because you know they're quite despondent because they're doing all that. And then the second half started and Rangers made it 2-1, and then it got to 2 weeks, and you're beginning to think this is not looking good here. And then with a few minutes to go, Rangers get the winning goal, and I will never forget that explosion. The roar and the sight of people, you know, it's like an open terrace and it's just a big heaving mass of people swaying back and forwards. And the contrast to half time was total, because we weren't singing and dancing anymore. It was the other end that were doing the singing and dancing. And that is, as a kid, that stayed with me forever. And it's a horrible memory. I don't mean that and to be disrespectful, but you know, when you're supporting your team and you see something like that, it's devastating. And Gordon Smith, that was his first Old Firm game, and he scored that day. He scored two that day, and he was recalling that on the park as I was recalling.
In the old Oval stadiums, that was one of the things that struck you—the noise and the bedlam from the other end, when there was silence all about you. I mean, funnily enough, the first Old Firm game. Well, I didn't finish answering your question. So end of the away terracing, and then was it the second row down? Go down the terracing slopes about two thirds of the way to the front, and then in on the left, and that's where we stood for 10 years. And funnily enough, the first Old Firm game I went to, I was never allowed to go to an Old Firm game. That was the one game my dad wouldn't take me to, and I wanted to go to a Rangers Celtic game, and eventually he relented on January 75.
Oh, 3-0.
And in his naivety, in my dad's naivety, he took me to the same spot
in the Celtic
we went to, me being a Rangers fan. And a number of, and I don't know why this irks, I don't know why this irks some Rangers fans, but it does. They think I'm concocting this story, and they've said it was all ticket, you couldn't have gone. I can assure you that game wasn't all ticket, because if it was, I wouldn't have been there. The all ticket thing must have come in later. It wasn't all ticket, it was pay at the gate. And my dad in his, and it's always tickled me to this day how my dad never thought about this. He finally relented January 75, as you say, a ploughed pitch, 3-0 to Rangers. And up we went to the usual spot, and I was, I'm not sure if I was wearing a Rangers scarf or not, but I was obviously supporting Rangers, surrounded by 30,000 Celtic fans. And when Rangers opened the scoring that day, and it was, do you remember, it was a dismal day, it was a ploughed pitch. It's a surreal experience hearing the roar from the other end while you're surrounded by solemn silence.
There's always that split second as well when a ball hits the net till when people roar.
Yeah, it's a delayed reaction.
I don't know what it is. You can only describe it if you're at the other end.
Yeah.
Doesn't he feel that way?
So I'm there, and my team has scored, and I've mentioned this a couple of times. I instinctively leapt up and cheered and punched my fist, and then was aware of this complete silence all around me, and this distant roar, like a distant storm away at the other side of the city, except it's the other side of the ground. And I instinctively cheered, and I can still remember a Celtic fan behind me just said, "Are you cheer for your team, son?" I just heard this voice. All right, you cheer for your team, son. But I remember kind of shriveling and thinking,
"Yeah,
right, okay."
That's quite magnanimous.
But it was fine. And I've told this story a few times, and I don't know why the Rangers hardcore, for some reason, object to this story. I don't know whether it's because it's viewed as treachery, or I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, or I don't know what it is, but it's a very vivid memory. My first Old Firm game that day in January 75, Ali McCoy, Ali Scott played for Rangers that day, a big beanpole. Right. Tommy McLean, in the way that he used to do, Tommy McLean used to deliver what I called 1970s crossbogs, not 90s.
High,
big
in
high wafting. You know, Glenn Hoddle in the early 80s suddenly appeared, and he would hit corners and crosses like free kicks, like javelins coming in. The Tommy McLean 1970s crossbow was the high wafting cross.
The hanging cross.
And somebody, was it Par Lane or Ali Scott? I don't know who it was, but somebody scored that day. In fact, I think Tommy scored that
Derek
day himself.
Derek Johnson scored the first one, Par Lane got the second one.
You remember this, right?
Tommy McLean got the last one.
So anyway, after that, I went home, and I remember saying to my dad, "Dad, you know, as great a game as that was, that was not a good idea, us going to our usual spot." So we didn't repeat that exercise. But it's funny. Guys who, Rangers fans today, who are maybe in their, say, 30 years old, or 35 or younger, who didn't know the old Oval Ibrox, they've missed out on a cultural gem. It was a classic British football stadium, but if you see pictures of it now, anytime I see a picture of the old Ibrox, I'm transported back to that arena. I can hear it, I can smell it, I can be there. And then certain things changed, like the Centenary Stand came into play, which was never popular. It was built round about, well, it'd be 73, but for some reason I always associate it with 74, 75. Where we were, if it was pissing down with rain at the uncovered terrace, and you were allowed into the Centenary Stand with about 20 minutes to go, we kids could run round the terrace and they'd let you in. But it was, the Centenary Stand at Ibrox then was benches as opposed to seats, and I my memory of it is that it was never a success with the fans. People didn't really go for it. And also, this might be wrong, but when I first went, before the Centenary Stand was built, I seem to remember that enclosure across from the main stand was where the Rangers singing went on. And then when the Centenary Stand was built, it moved round to behind the goal. But somebody, I must ask older Rangers fans about that. I remember that's where the Rangers choir was, in the old enclosure opposite the main stand.
There was a wee roof behind the goal, right?
Back of the terrace.
Yeah,
it wasn't a full roof.
Which led to the vocal support, because they had the roof on it and it came out a wee bit more, you know?
Yeah, but well, the Centenary Stand roof came right down to the front. But I may be wrong. I remember in 70, 71, 72, that was where the Rangers singing was. And then when the Centenary Stand was built, it moved round to the, what became moved round to the Copeland Road end. But the roof there was only only came down halfway down the terrace. In fact, maybe a third of the way down the terrace.
In the days of the old football grounds, as we're discussing, I remember, you might remember this game, it was 1980 Scottish Cup semi-final, just before the Riot Cup final. And Celtic played Hibs at Hampden. George Best was playing for Hibs, and I went to that day. But what I always remember is I was brought up in Govan, and Rangers supporting friends couldn't wait to get to Celtic Park for the other semi-final between Rangers and Aberdeen. For one reason, they all wanted to get into the jungle,
right?
Because the jungle had a sort of mystique, and Rangers hadn't played at Celtic Park for a number of years, but because it was a neutral venue, and Rangers got the Celtic end stroke jungle, and Aberdeen fans would have got the Rangers end, they couldn't wait to get into the jungle. And I always remember that they were talking about it for weeks on end, because they were so fascinated just to get in there to see what it was like. And maybe there's a wee bit of sort of like, this is where the hardcore Celtic fans all stand. But they were amazed about that, getting into the jungle.
Excuse me. No, it's funny. It's funny because when you mention that, I think in maybe 10 years of going to Ibrox when I was throughout the 70s, I think I only stood maybe two or three times at the old Copeland Road terracing. I remember once being there for a European game, and I must have gone, there was a mate of mine I used to go with, my dad, we'd always go to the spot I was mentioning, but maybe I went with another friend who always used to go to the Copeland terracing, the traditional Rangers end. But I think in all my time, and I mean virtually every home game at Ibrox, I mean maybe 20 times a season for 10 years, I think only two or three times did I go to the opposite end of the ground. And then when the stadium was rebuilt, I just kept going to the, I mean, I stopped going in the early 80s.
I was going to ask you that, it follows on, because the old Ibrox was converted into what is a modern Ibrox. Mm-hmm. So what would have been your opinion back in the day of the All-Seated Stadium? Because my recollection again for the guys in Govan was they weren't happy at the beginning. It was a cultural change, and it took a long time for football fans, Rangers fans, because everybody else still had the terrace. Mm-hmm. And although you still had the old enclosure at Ibrox, three quarters of the stadium was now seated. And in the beginning, my recollection is it wasn't very popular with the fans to begin with.
Well, do you know what? To be honest, I found the new Ibrox thrilling. I thought the new stadium looked really dramatic and exciting, and back, you know, we take it for granted now, but back then in the early 80s, I thought it wasn't innovative in the sense that it was unoriginal, but it was ahead of its time, I think. Mm-hmm. Ibrox to a degree, certainly in terms of other Aberdeen apart, maybe Kilbowie Park apart. Mm-hmm. It was ahead of its time, and I thought it was great. I mean, I think nostalgia can be overly unhealthy, and of course from the vantage point of today, we've just been talking about the old Ibrox. It was wonderful. It was fantastic. But at the time, mm-hmm. I didn't object at all to the new stadium. I thought it was brilliant. And mm-hmm. And as I say, I started going to the Broomloan stand. Funnily enough, as a kid, I never ever thought of it as the Broomloan end or the Broomloan Road end. But the minute the seating came in, I thought of it as the Broomloan stand or the Broomloan end. Mm-hmm. You know, but I never thought of it in terms of the road behind it in the 70s. But no, I thought the new stadium was great. I thought it was really exciting. I always found the gaps at the side, the four corners, a bit odd.
Yeah, and in a windy day, it wasn't very pleasant.
No, it wasn't, but I liked it. Do you remember that lurid colour scheme they had for about 10 years before?
It used to be brown, yellow, red.
Orange, or maybe not.
We used to call it everything bar green.
Aye, brown, yellow. Yeah, I remember it being really a bit of an eyesore, but I thought the stadium was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So, again, following on from the All-Seated Stadium, now we have safe standing as a big debate in the game today. So where do you stand in safe standing?
I'm happy to go back to it. There's clearly a lot of football fans who love standing at a game. I mean, self-evidently, they have problems all over Britain, not least at Old Trafford, where people refuse to sit. They all stand. I remember being at a Man United game one evening when they played a pre-recorded plea from Sir Alex Ferguson at half-time, begging people to sit down, not to stand. Mm-hmm. Now, the physics of this is beyond me, but the reasoning at Man United was there's some weight transfer between people standing and sitting, which could be structurally, could be a potential danger. I don't think it would be an imminent danger at all. But they had a problem at Old Trafford, so they got Fergie to make a plea to the fans to sit down. And it's happening all over Britain. Clearly a lot of football fans want to stand, and if they do, it cannot be beyond the ken of Peter Lawwell or Rangers or football clubs anywhere to have a safe standing area. And I know Celtic have been pushing for it, and let's bring it in and see how it works. I mean, we've had 20 years plus of all-seated stadium or something like that since the tragedies, so but clearly there's a move for it, and I'm for it. I fail to see why, with everything we know now and all the knowledge we have, I fail to see why it should be a potential death trap, which they were in the old days.
Some of the younger supporters, I think, don't appreciate how maybe I'm at a certain age now, and I don't want to stand. I like my seat, and I like the fact that I go there, I get the same seat every week. Mm-hmm. And I've got a good vantage point, and that's fair enough.
But clearly people do want to stand. Yeah. What I was going to say was...
But I think they might find that it's overrated. It's not as good as what they anticipate.
What I do find amazing is when you look at the old film of the Co-op at Liverpool in the late 60s, early 70s, I find it extraordinary there was not more tragedy than there was. When you see a little kid in the Co-op, and of course it was exciting to look at on film, but if you're a little kid standing there in 69, 70... Mm-hmm. on the Co-op at Anfield, and you're lifted off your feet and you're carried 20 yards down the terrace, and why there were not more injuries and fatalities, I don't know. The same applies to the dreadful Ibrox disaster of 71. I mean, when you think of the crowd surging down these exit stairways at the end of a game, how it never happened before, I do not know. I mean, it's the one that, by the grace of God, I mean, one tragedy was appalling enough, but by the grace of God, with that kind of unsophisticated attitude towards standing at football grounds back then, and the congestion and the lack of monitoring of numbers, God knows how there wasn't
the one that used to amaze me, that it never, as you said, by the grace of God, that there was never a disaster, was Hampden. The old Celtic end at Hampden, when you entered it and you went up it, it went up and up and up, and you used to think, how high can this get? And even when you got to the top, there was a wee shelf on top of it again.
Yeah, that's right.
So that you could get even up higher. And I remember going up there, it wasn't a busy game, it was a League Cup semi-final, and he said Celtic Hearts, mate, only about 20,000 at it. But my dad took me right up to the back, and it was like watching wee Subbuteo players.
Aye, I know.
It was watching wee ants. You're so far away and so high up, it was unbelievable. But the point about Hampden is, when you think of Celtic and Leeds, 136,000, Celtic and Rangers Cup finals of the 60s, 120,000, 130,000, Scotland England games, 140,000, you think, to squeeze that amount of people in there and nobody gets injured, it was a minor miracle.
Absolutely. That's the point I'm making. I don't know why there were, or how there were not more injuries. I mean, I remember the old Hampden as well, and I loved that. You're right, you could be very, very distant. Again, we had a kind of traditional spot at Hampden at the uncovered end, and I went to every cup final. Well, hang on, that's not strictly true, but the first cup final I went to was Celtic Dundee United 74.
That was mine as well. It was my
And then I remember racing up the old steps at the away end in 76 and missing Derek Johnson's opening goal.
The
Scottish Cup final goal that was scored before 3 p.m. because it kicked off at 2:58 the game for some reason. Can you imagine that now with live telly and all the signs they have, you know, kicked off early? And I can remember the roar. I can still remember my dad and I and my pal, my wee football buddy that used to come with us, hearing up the step, hearing the roar and missing it. And you turn up, you get to, and you're right. There was that level bit at the top.
You
crossed that, and then you went back down onto the old mud and the sleepers.
Yeah,
the old railway sleepers.
Yeah.
And then, Hampden was Hampden had to be upgraded. It was fantastic. And I think, you know what, just talking to you now, I think I probably am overly nostalgic for these days. These grounds were great, but the point came, never mind some of the terrible tragedies at Hampden, the point came when they had to be upgraded. I mean, people don't like the current Hampden because of atmosphere and everything else. Well, some people don't. Whatever you say about it, it's better than the old Hampden. If the old Hampden was here today, mud and dirt and sleepers, it would be regarded as medieval. It had to be erased, bulldozed.
So I was going to a Celtic game last season, and my son's 11, and he's sitting in the back of the car, and we were talking about something. I don't know how the subject came up, but it came up about Rangers no signing Catholics up to a certain stage.
Yeah.
And it's hard trying to explain to an 11-year-old something that happened maybe 30 years ago or whatever, and went before it, and he was totally flummoxed, and we didn't get into any great detail because there isn't any point bringing things like that up in the past. But the point I would make is your dad was a Baptist minister.
Yeah.
Right, and a good loving man, good Christian.
Yeah.
Would he, or even yourself as you got older, been uncomfortable with that policy at that point?
I think he probably was, yeah. It's funny, I never remember having a conversation with my dad about that, and you're right. I mean, he loved going to the football. We went to Ibrox every week. Via that, I became a Rangers fan as a kid. Everybody knows that I became severely lapsed later on in life because I became disenchanted with some of the things you've mentioned in that question. I don't remember discussing that with my dad, but of course he must have disapproved of it, because not only was he a Baptist minister, but he was very liberal. He had a very liberal kind of outlook on life, not just theologically but socially and politically and in every sense. So he would have severely disliked it, and I don't know whether he was actually kind of whether he compromised himself to a degree.
The way I would describe it is it was accepted practice.
Yes.
People might have thought, no, it's not very good, but you know something? It was a time of the communist bloc in Eastern Europe, it was a time of apartheid in South Africa. It was one of the things that people tended to just accept it and get on with it.
What happened with me was it definitely influenced my thinking as I got older. I just found it horrible, and look, you're right. I mean, it's past now. That policy's past, and it's well past, and it's way past, and there's no point in banging on about it. It's relevant only in one obvious sense, and that is that there's been a very unfortunate kind of legacy of it in some of the singing, some of the attitudes that have prevailed around Rangers and around the Rangers support, which have had to be tackled in recent years. I did find it ridiculous, and when I was writing a lot about bigotry and bigoted singing, and Rangers had a particular problem, I found it ridiculous that 30,000 people at Ibrox in 2006 were singing about Fenians or singing about Catholics. I found it ridiculous. The club had moved on from that, but the only sense in which it was relevant back then and in recent years was in a very real sense, which was the legacy was really unfortunate. I mean, the Rangers fans loved the Billy Boys, and it's had to be forcibly, killed off among them. They loved it, and I found that slightly.
They would say that that's
by the way, Celtic have not been immune from their problems of chanting, but the particular Rangers problem was a particular one for me, which I thought was a lot worse.
So what would you say to it if somebody said that that's a cultural thing?
I think
maybe not the Billy Boys, but maybe the Sash or Derry's Walls.
I don't have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with them, the Sash or Derry's Walls. I wouldn't sing them myself. By the way, I probably did when I was a kid, when I was a teenager. But when I became a grown man, I wouldn't be interested in singing them myself. But I don't really have a problem. If Rangers fans want to, they want to, whether it's for genuine reasons or whether it's for bogus reasons or whether it's for traditional reasons or whether it's for reasons they don't quite understand, they want to sing Derry's Walls and the Sash. I don't mind them. It's a foot stamper for them, isn't it?
Do you think in this day and age, but between you're offended?
I distinguished between that and the Billy Boys. I tried to distinguish with any Rangers song or any Celtic song which is tradition
but not offensive
and which you should kind of just live with, and the other ones that are blatantly prejudicial or blatantly offensive. I'm not into any of that stuff. But you know, Rangers kind of, Rangers FC got a raw deal from me in a way, because when I was, and I don't write about it just so much now because I do believe we've moved on and it's got better, but when Rangers had a particular problem in recent years, it was because of that legacy of that signing policy you mentioned, which was decades ago. And you know, of course it's embarrassing when you look back on it now. It's a bit like, you know, they didn't allow black golfers to play at Augusta National. We're embarrassed by it now. In the time then, in the here and now of then, people kind of didn't think it was so bad, did they? We move on in all these ways.
It was accepted practice. It was, you knew it probably wasn't right, but nevertheless, because it was done, that then people tended not to question it. I'll tell you a funny thing there where you're talking about chants and things. I had a friend of mine who was at a Man City fan when we were teenagers and in our 20s, and I used to go down there a couple of times a season to watch Man City at Main Road, and he used to come up and watch Celtic Park. And I remember one day we were standing in the Celtic end, and the Celtic fans were singing "Ooh Ah Up There Ah," right, one of the more unpleasant ones, if you like.
Yeah.
And he said to me, "What are they singing that for?" And I thought, "Oh God, you know, we're going to get into this big historical thing about the history of Ireland and the Battle of the Boyne in 1916 and that kind of thing." And he says, "Oh, I'm really, really confused why they would sing that." And I thought, "Well, you know," and he says, "Did Paul McGrann ever play for Celtic?" And I went, "What are you talking about, Paul McGrath?" He goes, "They're singing Ooh Ah Paul McGrath," because that was a popular song for Man United fans at the time. "Ooh Ah Paul McGrath," and he just heard it and couldn't differentiate. And I said, "Oh well, you know, I wasn't wanting to go through a big discussion at that point." And I said, "I'll tell you about it later when we get back to the pub," because it strikes you sometimes as being ridiculous when you've got a stranger there, and they begin to question things that you or I wouldn't maybe no question because we're brought up with that in that context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a time, we're still living in this age, aren't we, when rival fans are wired to the radio listening to songs of their rivals to try and grasp on them. The amount of times you heard Celtic fans singing "Ooh Ah Samaras," and I'd get emails from me, "Do you hear that Ooh Ah Up There Ah?" You know, I don't excuse Ooh Ah Up There Ah. Whether you don't often hear it at Celtic Park, but you certainly hear it on the road. And I mean, it's just plain shite, isn't it? Why, you know, I know that some Celtic fans want to say no, but it's political and it's look, you know, it's a really unfortunate song. It's like the Billy Boys. It's an unfortunate song. They might have different tones of offence, but it's the kind of stuff that Peter Lawwell and Celtic and Celtic fans could do without. Just as decent Rangers fans would say, you know, the songbook we've had has been really embarrassing and we could do without it. You know, but having said that, every time I wrote about these songs, I thought you were going to, when you mentioned England, I thought you were going to mention something else. I mean, I was always aware when I was writing about Rangers a lot and the singing problem at Ibrox, there are disgusting songs that the Liverpool fans sing about Man United fans. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what they are, about the Munich tragedy.
But I was going to the Man City
and there are disgusting songs that are aimed at Spurs fans and elsewhere. So, contrary to what people thought, I never believed it was unique to Rangers or unique to Glasgow or unique to Rangers and Celtic. There are offensive songs all over Europe, in Spain, in France, in the Balkans, everywhere.
Arguably, that's part of the local rivalry. You know, it's to try and rile your opponent in.
The other myth that used to get cast up at me when people used to say, "Oh yeah, Graham, you write about bigotry. You think Scotland's riven with bigotry?" Quite the opposite. I used to say Scotland is not riven with bigotry as a society. There is some, but it's nothing like it was 50, 60, 70 years ago. Nothing like it was. So if anyone thinks I labour under the illusion that I live in a country stinking with bigotry, the opposite is the case. I think we live in a brilliant country that's not got any of that professionalised bigotry it had 70 years ago. That's why the singing was so embarrassing, because it was a complete non-reflection, not a reflection, a non-reflection of the society we live in. We've moved on from the 1930s, 1940s things when Catholics were openly
discriminated
against in the working place, and the kind of unfortunate singing about Fenians and sad Fenian bastards and all this kind of thing, it actually gave a completely distorted view of the brilliant country we live in. That was my point. But people for some reason thought that I thought I lived in a country that was strewn with bigotry. I never thought that at all. That's why the football narrative was so unfortunate. It did damage to the reality actually of Scotland.
Right, we're going to have a wee bit of fun here, because part of the thing about the Celtic Rangers rivalry through the years was we always used to argue who was the best player.
Oh, right.
And the thing is about Celtic and Rangers that there was when you've got similar positions, there's always that wee bit, he's better than him, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'll call a couple of pairs, and in your objective opinion, you can tell me who you thought was the best, or we can discuss them.
Yeah, okay.
So, Jimmy Johnson, Molly Henderson.
Jimmy Johnson, but the truth is, Jimmy Johnson lasted a bit longer at Celtic, I think a bit longer than Willie Henderson did at Rangers.
Yeah.
So you're going back to a time when I wasn't around, the 1960s, I wasn't around Ibrox, and I'm absolutely willing to take on board what older Rangers fans say, that Willie Henderson was a brilliant wee player. But Jimmy Johnson, I think, would edge it.
But before we get any further, they're all good players.
But
we're not detracting anybody in any respect, we're just having a bit of fun.
And by the way, these two were great pals.
They certainly were, absolutely. Trevor Stephen and Paul McStay.
I think Trevor Stephen was probably a better player. The evidence for saying Paul McStay was a better player might have been more readily available had he played in England or had he gone to Europe, but he didn't. I'm glad he didn't. I want our best players to stay in Scotland. But I saw Trevor Stephen play some brilliant games in the old English First Division. I saw him play some brilliant games for Rangers, and I would say Trevor Stephen edged it.
Trevor Stephen was a wonderful player. In fact, Everton at the time, he had a great Rangers were fortunate to get Gary Stevens as well, so they had the two on the right hand side who were fantastic. Maybe the big one is Henrik Larsson or Brian Laudrup. And I say this as a big Laudrup fan, I thought he was phenomenal.
Laudrup was a genius. I would have to go for Larsson, because the ultimate currency is goals, isn't it? That's ultimately what counts. I know defending is important, and I know midfield is important, and I know Sandy Jardine was a brilliant fullback. The ultimate currency is goals, and Larsson was irreplaceable in that sense. So I would say Larsson. And also I would say about Laudrup, he'd played in Italy, he'd played in Germany, and actually this is similar to Larsson. For some reason, neither of them quite cut it. They were both brilliant players, but there's something a little bit problematic and something that makes you slightly uneasy about the fact that Larsson in Holland and Laudrup in Germany, to a degree, and at Fiorentina, to a degree, didn't cut it. And Rangers and Celtic saved their careers. In Henrik's case, it was quite amazing. If you were a Scandinavian player and you were deemed a good player, the great ambition was to go and play on the continent, or to mainland Europe, as they called it.
Yeah.
And the big come down was to go back home, a failure. And Henrik Larsson was at the airport in Holland, ready to go back to re-sign for whether it was Helsingborg or Gothenburg, I can't remember. And at the last minute, Wim Janssen sent a message, we'll take him, bring him to Celtic, just on a chance. Larsson was set to go back home with his tail between his legs, and Scandinavia would say a failure. Didn't quite make it a failure. Instead, I mean, his career flourished, and I think Larsson, to his great good credit, he famously said once, didn't he? He said, you know, of course I get lots of adulation. Larsson's been great for Celtic. He said, Celtic were great for me. And I think that's true. And the same was the same of Loudrup. I've got no doubt about the greatness of both players, but there's something, in terms of their greatness, there's something that just leaves you a little bit uneasy that they ended up coming to Scotland, and I'm glad they did. But what did it mean about their genuine kosher greatness in European terms? It just leaves a little scintilla of doubt.
The other thing I admire them for as well, and they both come in at the same bracket, is you get people who young boys in particular, and they're up the tune, they're in the dance, and something happens, is an incident, maybe a supporter for the other team riling them or something like that. And you know, in all the years that Larsson and Loudrup were here in the Goldfish Bowl of Glasgow, there was never an incident, and they also transcended the divide, if you like, because the Celtic fans that I'm friendly with thought Loudrup was wonderful. You know, we didn't like him because he was a great Rangers player, but you could not help but to admire his talent. And I think Henrik as well, there's guys over there who are Rangers fans who looked at Larsson and thought, oh, you know, what a player he is. So they had the respect of the opposition supporters, and they were never embroiled in this thing somehow about, well, it can't be helped, a young boy's a young boy. Well, no really, if you live your life properly and you're a true professional, you wouldn't find yourself in that position.
And also and like the old days, like the old Rangers and Celtic players of the 60s and 70s who easily crossed the barrier socially and were great friends, I think it was the case that even in the 90s and the early 2000s, during the Larsson period here, I think they were quite friendly with some of the Rangers players. I mean, Larsson knew Giovanni van Bronckhorst. I think they went out to dinner sometimes, and they went out for a pint. I'm pretty sure I saw them once together. I think I saw Larsson smoking in a pub one night
restaurant. That's well known.
From time to time. so there was that aspect, but quite interesting that period.
Right, so next one is Danny McGrain or Sandy Jarden.
Do you know, I couldn't spot. I'll sit on the fence. I mean, all these you know, either ors you're putting to me are pretty close, but that one I would say I couldn't separate them. I mean, I remember them just as a football fan, as a kid. I remember this brilliant football partnership we had, fullback partnership, McGrain on one side, Jarden on the other, weren't they? I mean, it was, you know, and
fantastic.
And I would find it hard. I think maybe I don't know. And they were both attacking fullbacks as well. They were both certainly Sandy Jarden was an overlapping fullback. I saw much more of Sandy Jarden as a player. I would, as you know, we would occasionally go over to Parkhead, but I would see
the
Danny
thing about Jarden is that there is an argument that Rangers actually let him go too early, because he was perceived as being at the crossroads of his career, if you like, you know, on the slide. And yet when he went to Hearts, he played for about 6-7 years at Hearts at a good level.
But that's always said, isn't it? I mean, I think Sandy, somebody can correct me on this, but I think Sandy Jarden had gone to Rangers in the mid 60s. He'd been there a long time. And it always happens, or it doesn't always happen, but it quite often happens that a big club lets a popular player go. I mean, I don't know what it was. I bet you Sandy Jarden would have been 31 or 32 when he left
Rangers.
That's
what I mean. He was perceived as being on the slide, but obviously it wasn't, because
I might be wrong about this, but I think Willie Henderson, the great Willie Henderson's Rangers career was finished at 28.
Well, what's even worse than that is Baxter.
Now, and Baxter, although Baxter had
Sad.
Baxter had gone to Sunderland, gone to Notts Forest, then I think, did he go to Sunderland? Yeah, he was in Notts Forest and Sunderland, came back to Rangers. I mean, Jim Baxter wasn't, when he came back to Rangers in 69, he wasn't interested in professional football anymore. But the Baxter, the original Baxter, must have been a genius. I mean, everybody, I didn't see him, but everybody says he was a genius. But in the old days, the point is, nowadays, if Rangers had a Willie Henderson at the age of 28, if they could, they'd give him a 5-year contract. But back then, my recollection as a kid was, in the 70s, if you got to 28, 29, you were really becoming a veteran. Certainly if you were 31, 32. Whereas, you know, Larsson left Celtic, I think, when he was 33, roughly, maybe 34. If he'd asked for a 3-year contract, Celtic would have given him one.
Correct.
Without any doubt. Yep. But not in 1972, not in 1975. If you're touching 30, you were finished.
Davy Proven or Davy Cooper?
Oh, that's a hard one as well.
I mean, always a big argument when I was a kid, because the Rangers fans idolised Davy Cooper.
Yeah,
we thought Davy Proven was a great player.
I've got into trouble with my estimations of Davy Cooper, who I really liked as a guy. I met him a few times and I found him a really likeable guy, and I know that he was a great Rangers player, but I don't put Davy Cooper in the genius class, which he effortlessly is put in by some. I don't put him in the world class, which he is effortlessly put in by some. And I've seen one Scottish sports writer who will remain nameless write that Davy Cooper was the best player he ever saw, which is clearly, for me, a ludicrous thing. If you've seen Zidane and you've seen Beckenbauer,
Cruyff,
if you've seen any of these players, I mean, it's a preposterous thing to write that Davy Cooper was the greatest player I ever saw. Although I'm willing to accept all these things are subjective, it just seems ludicrous to me. So I've got into trouble because as great a Rangers player as Davy Cooper was, I remember him being out of the team a lot. I remember Rangers fans in the late 70s, early 80s groaning over the name of Davy Cooper because he was so inconsistent. I remember one season at least, and I would need to go back and check it, but I remember one season at least when John Gregg was the manager, when a fit and available Davy Cooper probably played in no more than 40% of Rangers games. So I remember Davy Cooper as he was, and I think his, as fine a player as he was and as fine a bloke as he was, I think the passing of time has severely exaggerated his ability. With Davy Proven, I don't remember Davy Proven being a brilliant player, to be honest. I just remember him being a very good player and a very exciting winger for Celtic, who would deliver cross after cross after cross. But how many international caps did Davy Proven get? I suspect it wasn't a lot.
Proven only get off the top of my head 10 maximum.
Right, okay. I mean, you know, so.
But was at the time John Robertson had the winger's berth. He only played with one winger in those days. Yeah. He really played with two.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the game he did play in. Davy Proven supplied the pass, the great pass
Wembley.
For Archibald at Wembley in 81, right. It was, and you know what?
That pass
sums up Davy Proven. I mean, that was a you know this thing they used to say about the old days, and he played it, my memory is he didn't play it from out wide, he played it from the middle of the park. And the thing that you judged a great player back then, like Souness, was the genius at it, was that killing pass that killed defences, and it was like that. Archibald hardly had to break stride to meet that ball and stick it away. So But I'm rambling here, but the point is, I wouldn't have, when I remember Davy Proven, and I'll be careful what I say here because I meet Davy now and again, and he's a great guy, but I wouldn't have put Davy in the 50 caps class or the 60 caps class. His 10 caps would probably be a bit
right. I think the difference between Proven and Cooper in the days was Cooper would play, he would give you an 8, right? And then a 5 the next week and a 6 the next week. Whereas Davy would give you a 7, a 7, a 6.
Yeah.
You know, there was a consistency to Davy's game. He wasn't a mercurial winger.
Yeah.
He very rarely had a bad game.
Yeah.
But Cooper, I think, there was a Rangers fan of my acquaintance, and he used to say, we can tell in the first 5 minutes if he's going to have a good game.
Yeah.
If he beats the fullback and gets a cross in, chances are he'll have a good game. Typical winger.
Yeah. I wrote a column recently about Davy Cooper, in which I was pointing out, not for a first time, that I thought he was a really, really fine Rangers player. In some ways, a great Rangers player, but not bordering on genius. Yeah. Simply not bordering on genius. And I remember an Aberdeen fan got in touch with me, and he said, Graham, I just read your column about Cooper. He said, we dreaded facing Paul Gascoigne in his prime far more than Davy Cooper in his prime.
I would say Loudrop.
And he said, we dreaded facing Brian Loudrop in his prime.
Definitely.
Far more than we dreaded facing Davy Cooper in his prime. And in a blunt kind of way, that summed it up.
Yeah.
The Cooper memory is now greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, but the last one, Richard Goff or Mark McNally?
That's a
loaded question.
It's a loaded question. It's a kind of unkind question to ask. Of course it would be Goff.
That's just a bit of humour at the end.
Yes.
So you've got a call, well, I want to talk about your old column in Scotland Sunday.
Right.
And
here's trouble.
I think I know what's coming here.
In the days when I used to read it, was it your diary?
Yes.
The diary?
Yes.
Now, there's a few long standing subjects that you used to talk about, so let's go through them.
Right.
The first one was the extracurricular times of Elton John.
Reds.
You must be a fan.
Yeah, I'm an Elton John freak. In fact, we're speaking just now. He's in Glasgow this week. He's in Glasgow tomorrow night. Yeah, I've seen Elton John, I think, about 16 times in concert. First time was at the Glasgow Apollo in 79. Oh, no. Might have been earlier than that, because you won't understand this, but it was called the Blue Moves Tour. Any Elton John freak will understand that. It was the Blue Moves Tour, so maybe 77. I met Elton John once at a golf tournament in a prefab urinal at the World Match Play Championship down in Wentworth when he came in. He had a minder, and I met him and had a very brief chat with him, I'm sorry to say, in a prefab urinal.
Did you shake hands?
And I kind of... We shook hands washed our hands, yeah. And then I gave mine another quick wash, you know. I'm an Elton John. I'm an Elton John freak.
So the other thing you used to go on
about, the thing that's annoying about Elton John now is, as somebody said, back in the 70s, there was a time when Elton John was cooler than cool.
Oh, definitely.
He was
a man's man.
He was the coolest thing that walked the planet. Now he's like a stuffed turkey, and he's regarded as kind of the queen mum of pop.
Yep.
And he's become a caricature.
He's just regarded as a queen these days.
And you know, yeah. Now my wife, who's a bit younger than me, but by no means, not in any Clint Eastwood way of 29 years younger, you know, but she missed the whole era of Elton John when he was cooler than cool.
Mm.
And to my absolute despair, I try and point this out to her, she just doesn't get it. He was like Robbie Williams was 10 years ago. He was,
well, what
he
I always
was
say
ace
is,
cool.
What I always say is Elton John pre-80, yes. Post-80,
yeah.
Nah.
Yeah. I mean, Elton John, Good by Albert Road, Elton John, Captain Fantastic, was to die for. Yeah.
So the other thing you used to go on about as well was the... the Scottish Junior FA, after there'd been a riot on the park and off the park,
there shall be an inquiry. Who
was that guy's name?
Was it Joe Black? Was it not? Because is there an actor called Joe Black?
There's a film called Joe Black.
Maybe I'm getting mixed up, but I can't remember. There was a really nice guy, poor guy, who was the president of the Scottish Junior.
Some guy would have a broken jaw, another guy, there would be police getting called into the deepest, darkest air cell. And all he would say is, "There'll be an inquiry."
I mean, it sounds pathetic now, but I got into this groove. Yeah, I used to say there was head and notepaper, and there was this kind of arched wording, "There shall be an inquiry." That was the logo of the Scottish Junior Football Association. There were things like, funnily enough, I now live in Ayrshire. And I love Ayrshire, but back then, I thought the Ayrshire juniors in particular were ludicrous. There was a game between
Kilwinning.
One of the teams was called, I remember thinking that the very sound of the teams that were playing sounded like they were knocking nine bells out of each other. Knocking Tibber. It sounds like a riot, doesn't it? Knocking Tibber. Knocking Tibber were playing somebody, and there was a genuine game when the police arrived at half time and lifted two of the players and took them away, arrested them. And it summed up the Ayrshire Junior scene. But yes, I got into this unfortunate groove, and it lasted about 5 years. I couldn't get out of it. What happened was people started sending me anecdotes and snippets. And funnily enough, there was one Christmas in about 94 when it was a strange Saturday when nothing was happening. And Scotland on Sunday at the time said, "You know what? Cumlick are playing Auchinleck in the junior, in a cup tie, go to it." And I went to it, 23rd of December, 94. People still send me this piece I wrote. I kind of wrote up this piece about all the colour there. But I remember driving to the game thinking, my God, what will happen here if this in reality doesn't bear out the part myth narrative that I write about, i.e. aggro anywhere. I thought, I'll be rumbled. But as it turned out, there were two sendings off and seven bookings or something, so it turned out fine. But I went to the game down there at Townhead Park, and the pavilion was bricked up, I remember, and one of the guys that got sent off was a guy called Montgomery, and he watched from the second half drinking a can of Tennent's and having a fag from one of the windows of the pavilion that wasn't bricked up. And I thought, right, okay, I was right about the Ayrshire Juniors all along.
The other thing you went on about, I think it's dead funny as well, is obviously did a wee bit of research, was the 1978 World Cup. Now, everybody looks back in that, if you can remember the time, and thinks, I knew it was coming. I knew they were going to fall on their face. I knew Ali McLeod was going to sort of like it implode.
Yeah, but not before it.
No.
Yeah.
No, but what was interesting was to read the research you did about Jerry McNeese and the Ian Archers and the Alec Camerons of the world, who were literally writing that we were going to finish in the top four and get to the semi-finals.
Yeah,
but after the event, they made it as if somehow that they knew. They told us beforehand that it was all going to be a shambles.
Yeah, I mean, it shows how sad I must have been back then in the 90s, because I had time in my hands to go and do all that research, and I remember that got me into a bit of trouble, not surprising, with a lot of the older hacks. What I did was I became very suspicious of guys who were still on the go at the time. Alec Cameron, who was a smashing guy, Jim McNee, who's still a friend of mine, great guy, really. Jerry's a brilliant guy, funny company, and a lot of these characters, and there was a very distinct whiff of being wise after the event, which I was suspicious of. So I went back, and I was saying I was sad because I spent hours combing through the libraries, and here was all this stuff from all the main men talking about, we've surely got a chance of the last four, we've surely got a chance of the last eight.
If we don't make the quarter finals, it'll be a disaster.
Yeah. And Ian Archer, of course, made this famous comment when the draw was being made live on television, if Scotland don't get to the last eight, looking at the Holland was in the group in Peru, they were all pretty dismissive of it. And then afterwards, they kind of course, did this 180 degree intellectual somersault on it. And said, we knew the hype before it was terrible.
Yep.
You guys were writing the hype.
That was great reading in the 90s, because I recall that era and I remember the euphoria that went with it. So it's true to say that these guys were, printing a lot of rubbish, but they forget what they were doing.
Having said that, I'm very happy to point out that we all do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've written stuff where I became wise after the event. I mean, I can think of stuff. I remember the first time I saw Duncan Ferguson as a player. Thank God nobody can dig out that they could if they wanted to. Some point in Scotland Sunday, he was making either his second or third appearance for Dundee United, and I looked at this guy, and I'd played football all my life, played amateur football, loved football, seen a stack of football, and I wrote him off as a no-hoper. And we all make these ludicrous mistakes.
So the other thing that again, with your diary at that point, is you were probably the first guy that was critical of David Murray in any respect. And what I'm going to say there is, do you feel vindicated now after what happened to Murray? Could you maybe see something that the rest of us were missing?
I'd answer the last question in all modesty by saying no. I mean, I was critical from David Murray from quite a long way out, but it was not over some of the things that ruined Rangers, that ruined Rangers FC. For example, to be specific about it, it was not about you. I had no foreknowledge or foresight about EBTs. I heard EBTs being mentioned, and we kind of wondered what they were. Every Rangers AGM would come and go in the kind of 01, 02, 03, 04 period, and you heard somebody from the floor would raise up EBTs, and somebody said, oh, that's a tax issue. We just regarded it as a tax issue. We all became much more illuminated about that, both Rangers fans, Celtic fans, and journalists later on. My main criticism of David Murray from the outset, or from about, maybe from about 99, 2000 onwards, was the culture of David Murray, the largesse, the recklessness, the overindulgence. And I keep saying this. I mean,
did you come up with the succulent lamb thing?
I
use that as ridicule.
I get it's bizarre today. Younger generations of Celtic fans who get in touch with me on Twitter, who have got no idea that I originated the original succulent lamb joke, and was there at the time when it happened, they say to me, Graham, let me explain to you what succulent lamb means. You know, I say, oh, give me peace. I'll tell you all about it. You know, there's a younger generation Celtic fan who simply doesn't know the origins of it. But what happened was, when I started writing about succulent lamb in 98-99 in my sports diary, it was just at the beginning. It was just at the very beginning of the internet age, and it was picked up by some Celtic fans, and it kind of gestated for a little bit. It was there for 2 or 3 years, and then the succulent lamb joke or line, whatever you want to call it, got a whole new life around about 2003, 2004, 2005, and then of course it became a running joke, not just with Celtic fans, but it was lying dormant for a while from when it appeared in print in my diary in the 90s. And then what happened is, of course, it became a running joke when the ruin of Rangers was happening and when journalists were being criticised for being sycophantic. The point was, younger Celtic fans to this day, they remain oblivious about my role at the start of it. And I get these ludicrous tweets from them saying, "Graham, let me tell you a joke about Sutherland and let me tell you what it means." And I said, "All right, okay, you tell me what it means then and I'll patiently listen, you know."
Right, so... you were one of the first guys to be critical of Murray. Did you feel that would he have regarded you as an outsider at that point?
No, I was. I got on very well with David Murray in the early 90s as a journalist, and I'm very happy to say he was really good to me. He was quite a decent guy. I think he is quite a decent guy. He was quite a decent guy to me. It was kind of hard for me editorially to turn on him in a way, because I'm quite open about the fact he was. I found him quite a decent guy, and he was quite good to me as a journalist. I would speak to him every week. He would tell me things that were happening at Rangers. He would give me tip-offs. He would actually give me tip-offs in confidence, which I couldn't use. So I knew quite a lot of things that were happening at Rangers, which would appear down the line somewhere. And I would constantly kind of curse myself that Murray had told me about this, and I wasn't able to put it in print. Nonetheless, that was the basis of the relationship we had, and he trusted me. And but what happened was, I had to break free in a way, because I wasn't a news gatherer or a news breaker. It was never my role in journalism. They wanted me to be a columnist. They wanted me to be a feature writer. And when I thought Rangers were financially overheating, and when I thought there was growing evidence of kind of recklessness and overindulgence on David Murray's part, I had to write about it in print. I had to write about it in columns. So when I went to the Herald in 2000 and I became pretty critical of David Murray in about 01, 02, 03, 04, it's human nature that our relationship suffered as a result of it. I mean, people tell me this, you know, I've heard it being said on the internet, or people have said to me, "Oh, you had a big fallout." We didn't have a big fallout, or there was a big row about something. There wasn't a big row. It was just a gradual editorial thing. I felt duty bound as a columnist to say, I'll give you an example. Rangers went three successive years round about 2001, 02, 03 when they lost. They made a $29 million loss one year. The next year they made a £32 million loss, and the next year they made a £30 million loss. I mean, it was impossible for me not to highlight that and be critical about it and say that something was dangerously overheating at Rangers. I repeat again, I'm claiming no foreknowledge of EBTs, which was actually what brought Rangers down. It was just that the culture of David Murray was what I had to write about, and it meant that what had been a very good human working relationship between the two of us was kind of broken. It was inevitably severed, and that's why it happened.
Was it difficult for you as a Rangers fan to accept criticism from your supporters who thought wrongly that you were being anti-Rangers?
Well, it's obviously hard for me to describe this because nobody seems to believe me. I'm not a Rangers fan, and I wasn't a Rangers fan, and I haven't been a Rangers fan since about the age of 21, 22. I mean, it's 30 years ago. There's something I don't understand, because guys like you and other people say to me, "No, that can't be right. No, I've actually heard people say, 'No, no, you are a Rangers fan, Graham.'" But I give up. I just give up explaining it to me. If they want to tell me what I am, then that's fine. I've never been a Rangers fan when I've been a working journalist. I was severely lapsed from the age of 21, 22.
Surely you are what you are. I mean, whether you go and work in Africa, in deepest, darkest Africa, but you know, I'm talking from personal experience. At 25, every Saturday, my heart will be at Celtic Park.
You make it sound like pigmentation. It's just there. It's not like that. Funnily enough, I've been in the back of a taxi, and I've actually heard taxi drivers occasionally say to me, "Oh yeah, you know, I used to be a big Celtic fan, but I'm not interested anymore, and I've not got it." And I thought, do you know, that's really weird, because when I explain my emotional situation in football, people don't believe you. They say, no, like Graham. People actually have said to me, "Graham, listen to me, Graham. You are a Rangers fan." And I say, "But I know me much better than you, and I'm telling you." So anyway, you obviously don't believe me, so I won't waste time on it. But to answer your question, when I was writing about Rangers, If anything, the truth was I'd become so disenchanted with Rangers. There was no emotional legacy at all. Mm-hmm. There was no supporter legacy at all. It had been there as a kid. That had been absolutely steeped in me. But whether you guys think it's a freak of the laws of the universe or not, it just disappeared. I don't know where it went. It just disappeared.
You wrote a book about Paul Gwynn.
Yeah.
Okay, so in hindsight again, it's easy to be... talk about things in hindsight. Should Rangers have persevered then? Would it not have been a better thing to do?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was... My God, when I think back to that, I can very clearly remember the summer of 2006, and I was really, really intrigued and excited about Paul Le Guin coming to Rangers. I thought it was going to be brilliant for Rangers. I thought it was going to be brilliant for Scottish football. I thought it was going to be brilliant for the Celtic-Rangers rivalry. Mm-hmm. In every sense, I thought it was going to be great. I thought he was different. I thought he was fresh. That's why I have this little thing about Mark Warburton. Is it the right thing? Surely it's a risk. And it's partly linked to Le Guin, because the thinking with Warburton now is exactly what the thinking was back then. You see it everywhere. Rangers need to think outside the box. Rangers need to think differently. Well, that's what they did with Le Guin, and I thought he was going to be the man. Funnily enough, Peter Lawwell told me that he knew a guy in Lyon, and I only found this out later, who had said to Lawwell, I'm sure Peter Lawwell won't mind me mentioning this now, but I think he probably told me in passing 10 years ago, whenever it was, less than that. There was a guy in Lyon who had said to him, Le Guin won't work at Rangers. This was in about June 2006 when Le Guin was coming. Mm. Peter Lawwell mentioned this. A guy had written him a letter and had said to him, I'm telling you now, he was a Scot who lived and worked in Lyon and went to watch football. Le Guin will fail at Rangers. And his reasoning was, because of the whole dynamic between, in France, they had sporting director and a coach. Mm. Le Guin at Lyon was a coach whose sporting director was a guy called Bernard Lacombe, who did all the signing.
Yeah, yeah.
He came to Rangers not as a coach, he came to Rangers as a manager, in a different dynamic,
yeah,
and with different, working in a slightly different environment, well, working in an alien environment in terms of Scottish football, but working in a slightly different dynamic in terms of his job. And it was interesting, this anecdote from this guy turned out to be very prophetic. So, my God, I'm taking a long time to answer your question. I remember David Murray saying at the time, we've gone the extra mile for Paul Le Guin, and I don't know if we can go any further. And you know what? I think when they were 17 or 18 points behind Celtic by that December, I went step for step with Le Guin because I wanted to write about him and I wanted to get to know him, and I'll probably do the same with Warburton because he's interesting. I decided to follow him and be around him, and I found him really likable. But a number of people, I noticed today, a number of Rangers fans are prone to say, maybe we should have stuck with him. Maybe it would have worked. Look at the way other people are given time. I think Rangers had to cut him loose. Mm-hmm. I think by the time it got to early January 2007, when Rangers played that game at Fir Park.
Is that the one that Boyd scored?
Boyd scored, and there was disharmony, and there was dissension with Boyd and Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And Le Guin said to me, when I went to see him in Paris later on for my book, Le Guin said to me, I phoned David Murray, and I said to him, this isn't working, let's stop it. And I remember David Murray was really annoyed at the time because I think the Sun had said, they carried one of their back page cartoons, said, you know, he's getting a pile of money for going. David Murray subsequently clarified and said, Paul Le Guin said, pay only for my removal van. Mm-hmm. Pay for nothing else. You owe me nothing else. Mm-hmm. So I thought Le Guin was a guy of real honour. Mm-hmm. But I think they had to let him go.
You know, moving on to the current... moving on to Celtic, to be honest, Ronnie Dyla, it may be similar to Le Guin, come into a club that he didn't know nothing about, an environment he didn't know much of, a country that he probably didn't know much of either. So were you impressed with Dyla's first season?
Well, he came good, didn't he? I mean, my view, I wrote a column on the day dialer was unveiled, and I thought it was an imaginative and a bold move by Celtic in some ways, and an impressive move in some ways to get this guy. But just as with Mark Warburton, I thought it was a risk.
Mm-hmm.
I did. It was much less of a risk for me, for Celtic, than it was for Rangers, because Celtic were in a strong position. Rangers have been in a very vulnerable position. And in a vulnerable position, I think you should minimise risk. But Dial, I thought, was still a risk. But I quite admired Celtic for doing it. Of course, the whole thing was undermined, and Dial was undermined by the whole Roy Keane chase, which I thought was absolutely ludicrous. Roy Keane, for me, is not a manager, and would have been a hothead at Celtic, and I think would have been a disaster. Who knows? We don't know. But of course, it's perfectly obvious. For me, it's perfectly obvious Dialer wasn't their original first choice. But anyway, they got Dialer, and I think it's turned out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's grown in stature, and he's maybe, similarities to a degree with Le Guin, he's maybe a classic case of somebody who's shown if you hang in there, if you persevere with him, you know, he'll come good, and he did come good. The whole thing, of course, is predicated on the fact that there's been no Rangers. How would Ronnie Dialer have got on with a strong Rangers competing against him? We don't know. Well, I was going to say we don't know. We know this. It would have been tougher.
Mm.
It would have been a lot tougher. Would he have won the league had he been facing an Advocaat Rangers or a McLeish Rangers or a Walter Smith Rangers from 2009-2010? Maybe not. We don't know.
Mm.
But he came good.
Mm.
And you know, I would have loved Le Guin to have come good at Rangers, and he didn't. I'm really pleased that Dialer has come good at Celtic. But for a while, I remember saying, I think round about November last year, and a lot of Celtic fans were the same. If this guy doesn't really turn the corner quickly, it's going to be curtains. That's what a lot of people thought.
Now, at the moment, you've had some good feature interviews recently with old players. For example, the ones I enjoyed was Hamish McAlpine, Willie Pettigrew, Ronnie McKinnon. There was one you did with Tony Fitzpatrick, which was heartrending. When you look at Tony, you really wrote well about that. That was a fantastic feature. So really all I'd like to ask is, any football person dead or alive you could choose to interview, who would you have picked?
Oh, wow. Any footballer dead or alive? Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Well, I would have loved to have, from a purely footballing point of view, I would love to get the chance to spend 2 hours with Beckenbauer and ask him about defending. I would love to.
That's a possibility. He's still alive.
I would have loved to have got the chance to speak to Puskas, Di Stefano, some of these players from a previous age who lived in a different time. Within the Scottish context, I've been pretty lucky because I've interviewed a lot of these former players, and I really enjoy it. I really enjoy it. I would have loved to have. I interviewed Jock Wallace once in the mid to late 90s, but in a way it didn't really work because he was pretty ill at the time, and it was a sad case. But Jock Wallace would have been interesting for me because I would have asked him about a time that I knew inside out at Rangers because I was there, albeit watching from the terracing. It's unbelievable to me. I think of Jock Wallace as being a seasoned veteran. It's unbelievable to me that he was handed the Rangers job when he was 35. I think of him.
And he had no previous experience.
And he had
manager.
No previous as a manager. I mean,
he'd been a coach, but he'd never been a manager.
I wrote about this recently because I've used the line a lot that experience counts for a lot. Jock Wallace had never been a manager, and he got the Rangers job. I would have loved to have interviewed Jock Wallace about that whole time. He was a different time and place.
I spoke to Andy Lynch recently, and he was talking about Jock Wallace. Andy Lynch had signed for Hearts, and Jock Wallace was the first team coach at Hearts. I think the manager was a guy called Bobby Seath. And I thought somehow that Andy wouldn't have been Jock Wallace's type. He was a player, and you know, whatever. And Andy Lynch says, you know, Big Jock had a certain reputation, but he wasn't like that. He says, I remember when he left to go to Rangers. He says he came up and there was Andy Lynch and a guy called Jim Townsend, who were good Hearts players at the time. And he came up and he grabbed the two of them and he gave them big bear hugs. And he says, if you were only a couple of times, you'd be my first signing at Ibrox. He says, and that was the best accolade that Jock could give you if he would sign for Rangers. And he says, people used to think he was this big, sort of gruff, aggressive guy. And he says, no, behind the scenes, that's not the Jock Wallace.
Gordon Smith is very. insightful on Jock Wallace. I mean, Gordon, every time I speak to Gordon about football or about Rangers, I always find him quite illuminating about Wallace. Gordon says that, you know, of course it's true what Jimmy Nicol said once, that once you've had a half-time team talk from Jock Wallace, you want to go out and tear the opposition limb from limb. Mm-hmm. But Gordon Smith always says, no, you know what, Jock had a tactical nous about him and would say things and would set Rangers up to play in a certain way, sometimes in European games, sometimes in cup games, that were different and were varied. And Gordon always said it's in part a myth that he was just this big bear of a man.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I mean, it was very obvious to me that although Jock Wallace was part of a environment at Rangers that we now, with easy hindsight, we now view as very unfortunate, the whole bigotry thing around the club. I mean, at the time, of course Jock Wallace had great human kindness about him. I'm sure he did. And I'm sure he had a real hardened decency about him. And he would look out for you. He was a growling guy for knee-knocking sports reporters to go and deal with at a time. But he had great qualities. And I'll say this, you only need to look at the history books to know that what a great Rangers manager he was.
Mm. Two trebles in 3 years?
Two trebles in either...
Three seasons.
Yeah. 75 and 78, well, 76, so whatever it was, yeah. So he came at the end of the, you know, and of course the steam period was probably waning. Well, it definitely was. But nonetheless, it is beyond argument what a great manager Jock Wallace was. It's quite interesting. Mark Warburton has made these comments about, you know, I mean, he did not, as a young trainee at Leicester City, Warburton played under Jock Wallace. Yeah, and did not rate him in the slightest. Mark Warburton has said, Jock Wallace taught me how never to treat a footballer, never to treat a player like that. And Warburton said that he loved football, and Jock Wallace made him hate football. And he left. But this kind of, because I think Warburton's made a bit of a joke about it now. He's had to, actually. Yeah. And he knows fine well what a great Rangers manager he was, but he made some really, really damning comments about him.
So your dad was a minister,
yeah,
right? And you did a recent interview with Bishop John Keenan.
Yes.
So would you regard yourself as a spiritual person?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's maybe overstated. I mean, I grew up in a manse. I grew up going to church. I still love the church with a capital C. And by the church that I love, I mean Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Catholic, Anglican, Reformist. I love the church. I love the Christian church in all its guises and with all its faults. But having said that, having made that kind of quasi kind of confession of faith, I mean, I'm not kind of, you know, I'm not a raving evangelical. I'm not a raving Bible basher.
Do you remember writing an article about Harry Connick a few years back? Harry Connick came to Glasgow, and he said that he always visited the cathedral in the city that he was playing in, and you made the comparison.
Right.
But you've been fortunate to travel to a lot of places.
Yes.
And you always make a point of going to local churches.
Yes, one of the things I used to do was, I mean, I'm no longer a beat reporter, but I did what's called beat reporting for 20 years, where every wheeze and fart, every press conference, every game, every trip, you do that kind of beat reporting. I did all that. So I've done all these trips everywhere with Rangers and Celtic in Scotland. And I used to love, if I was in Brussels or Milan or Barcelona or Valencia or Salzburg or Vienna or Munich or Moscow, I could name all these cities I was taken to. I would love to go to a cathedral or a sacred place and just be there, because the life I had and the life I still have to a degree was pretty rum and pretty kind of laddish in a way. You know, you'd go on these trips, you'd go out for a pint, you'd go out for dinner, you'd have a laugh. Mm. Everybody knows what the press pack is like. Nobody's got any illusions about us, you know. And I used to like just a bit of space and solitude. So, yeah, I really love the church.
So
in all its different guises.
Can we expect more interviews in that vein?
Well, I mean, I like journalistically, I like writing about spiritual issues. I actually like writing about things that men don't like writing about. Issues of emotion or love or faith or spirituality. I kind of like writing about these things because it's part of my background. So I've interviewed Catholic bishops, I've interviewed Protestant ministers, I've interviewed Church of Scotland moderators. Mm-hmm. I like the... I'm interested in the whole story of faith, because I've been steeped in it, so that's where that comes from.
Well, I think we've taken up enough of your time, Graham. I just want to thank you for your input there. That was terrific. I really enjoyed that, and I hope you've enjoyed it also.
Aye, good to meet you. That was quite interesting. Aye, you've reminded me of a few things I'd forgotten about.
And we'll keep a wee eye on your career as well and see how you develop. And you might even get that award for a 15.
Aye, well, okay. Well, you say a prayer for me and then.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, it's good to meet you. Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Okay, thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that, and we've already got podcast number 252 lined up. It was the guest who I did think was going to be number 251, but he was busy that day and then went on holiday the next day, busy with a news story, as you'll find out when the guest comes along, unless he's busy again when I'm due to meet him this week. Anyway, that was him, Rocket Man Graham Spears, with him, St. Anthony. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying God bless and good night. Good night. Final thing, with the clients getting such positive publicity for their return this past week, I thought I'd have a Clangers related song to play us out, so see if you can work out what it is. Those of you who are taking you back to the right about 1990, I think it is. Anyway, good night. Good night. We'll be right back.